Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, believing growth and productivity of Florida depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust encourages all businesses to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital staff members. More information is at abletrust.org. WFSU-FM Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
On this final Capitol Report of 2016, we'll look backward and forward when it comes to issues like the impact of redistricting on the recent election.
Well, you know, I think somebody's done some rigging.
The death of longtime Cuban dictator Fidel Castro brings tears and cheers.
We were so happy because Fidel got rid of a dictatorship for us, she said. Then he brought his own dictatorship with him.
We'll also learn how the horror of the Pulse nightclub shooting has revamped disaster response plans and if fracking, defeated in this year's Florida legislature, might have a better chance next year. I'm Tom Flanagan, and this is Capitol Report. It seems just about everyone knew this year's election was going to be one for the history books, but what remains poorly understood, even by many political pundits, is just how important the placement of election district lines is when it comes to who wins and who loses elections. In the run-up to the 2016 balloting, Florida Public Radio's Kate Payne and Nick Evans teamed up to literally walk the line of one newly redrawn voting district in Florida's capital city. Here's their story, which originally aired before the November election, followed by Kate and Nick's postscript.
It's a hot, sunny afternoon in Tallahassee. I'm walking through Congressional District 5. It stretches from here all the way to Jacksonville. And demographically speaking, it leans pretty hard to the left.
But over here, literally right across the road.
I'm in District 2. It sprawls across 19 North Florida counties and picks up half of Tallahassee. And this district is much more Republican.
This is Branch Street.
It cuts right through a neighborhood called Levy Park.
Neighborhood of the year, 2013.
And for four blocks, this is the line separating District 2 from District 5.
If you live on one side, your representative will probably be a Democrat. But on the other, it'll probably be a Republican.
Branch Street has this classic neighborhood feel. The schools, the park, and the grocery store are all just a few blocks away. People know their neighbors, and the kids actually play outside.
We're working on a story about this neighborhood.
Oh, I'm so sorry. Jim Robert, will you wait just a second?
There are lots of little wooden houses called bungalows. Think front porches and screen doors. And some people on Branch Street are pretty surprised to hear they now live on the dividing line between two deeply partisan districts.
That makes no sense whatsoever.
This is Pam Jones, trying to make sense of the new district maps. Leon County used to be all in one congressional district, CD2. But the new CD2 spans the panhandle from Panama City to Ocala, picking up half of Leon County. The rest of the county is lumped in with Congressional District 5, which runs the Florida-Georgia line from Gadsden County to Jacksonville. CD5 leans hard to the left, CD2 hard to the right.
I think somebody's done some rigging.
Other neighbors are well aware of the changes. Steve and Penny Whitaker are Democrats, and they're happy to live on the Democratic side of the street.
Yeah, this street is the dividing line.
John.
Poor John on the other side.
John, yeah,
but up and down Branch Street, the question keeps coming up. Why here?
Excuse me. Hi. He's very excited.
This is Isaac Miller and his dad, Henry.
I think it's silly. I mean, you know, I know my neighbors across the street a lot better than I know anybody in Ocala.
For the people on this street, poring over these maps that split their neighborhood in half, it feels arbitrary, careless even, and that undermines their faith in the system at large. One person we spoke to says those feelings are justified. Nick Quinton is a redistricting expert, and he lives on Branch Street. Seriously. He says this kind of redistricting doesn't mean voters get better representation.
Yeah, I think the argument that we're getting more
partisan because of redistricting is entirely valid. I don't know how you get around it. And it blows my mind that we don't talk about that more than we do.
And for Quentin, the irony is everyone on Branch Street, Democrat or Republican, CD2 or CD5, they're all going to vote at the same polling place.
You know, we vote here. We vote at the church. And if you could get somebody at the church to talk to you.
Good morning.
We're at 1609 Branch Street at the Family Worship and Praise Center.
This is Michael Fry. He's a church deacon, and he's been working elections here since 2004. And it's true. No matter which side of Branch Street a voter lives on, this is where they'll cast their ballot. Come August 30th, he'll be here early, making coffee, laying out snacks, and opening up the doors for poll workers. Residents living on opposite sides of the street find themselves in different districts, but they come together on election day at the local church. It's actually a bit of a nightmare for election supervisor Ion Sancho.
The map shows that the legislature drew a line right through an existing Leon County precinct.
And on a map, he shows us Branch Street isn't the only place where the old precincts and new maps didn't quite line up.
This is what it looks like now. And you can see all of these little discrete, these are little carve-outs. Here, here, here.
It's complex, as in 612 different ballot styles in Leon County alone complex. And it just raises the question, why Branch Street? Why any of these streets?
So the short answer of it just comes down to race.
Race. That's Matt Isbell. He's a mapping expert who does a lot of work with groups aligned with the Democratic Party. And what he's talking about is District 5, the one running from Tallahassee to Jacksonville. It's a minority access seat, which means the minority community needs to be able to elect a candidate of its choosing. But there's a fine line between minority access and minority packing. The Florida Supreme Court decided the Republican-controlled legislature crossed that line in 2012, and it sent lawmakers back to the drawing board. But Isbell explains there's another consideration that encourages district borders along small streets like Branch, and it's sort of the most fundamental tenet in elections.
The requirement that our districts have a population deviation of one.
One person, one vote. Isbell says this demand, that congressional districts be equivalent in population plus or minus one person, can actually force mapmakers to split neighborhoods, like Levy Park.
That creates a scenario where in order to get that number, which you normally are drawing these districts with census blocks, you have to basically find that one census block that's got 5 people or 10 people or this. And that's not just a census block, that's a neighborhood. That's like a community.
Under the new map, Democrat Al Lawson won CD5 and Republican Neil Dunn won CD2. So no surprises. Florida will still be sending more Republicans to Congress even if Democrats picked up an additional seat. But looking at the presidential vote by congressional district, the partisan breakdown is almost even. Trump carried 14 to Clinton's 13.
But Florida's new districts will be in for more changes one way or another. The upcoming Constitutional Revision Commission will put amendments directly on the ballot. And House Speaker Richard Corcoran says he'll appoint members who will undo the Fair Districts Amendment. That could open the door for more gerrymandering when lawmakers draw new maps in 2022. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Kate Payne.
And I'm Nick Evans.
Still to come on Capitol Report, we'll recall the terrible night a lone gunman caused carnage at an Orlando nightclub and what's occurred since to deal with future mass casualty events.
What you're not prepared for is this machine that was just continuously creating patients. So here's your patients now, well, here's more patients.
Soundly defeated during the 2016 lawmaking session, the issue of fracking is once again likely to send seismic waves through the Florida Capitol in 2017.
You know, I'm so disappointed that the proponents of this bill won't stand up here behind Senator Richter and explain to us why this is good public policy.
What will become of the site of a long-closed Florida reform school where unspeakable horrors once occurred?
Some of the most diabolical, sadomasochistic acts known to man.
The Pulse nightclub tragedy in Orlando this year dominated national attention for a time as the worst mass shooting in modern American history. It left Floridians reeling and raised questions about the state's readiness to handle major disasters, as we hear from Health News Florida's Abe Ibarraya.
For 20-year-old Patience Carter and her two best friends, That Saturday night of dancing at Pulse Nightclub was literally the best night of her life. And then the shooting started. Carter immediately dropped to the floor and started scooting backwards.
I didn't even realize it until I was outside, like, with my hands on the grass, and Akira hovered over me, and I see the sky behind her head, so I'm just like, where's Tierra?
That question prompted Carter to make a split-second decision. She and Akira Murphy went back into Pulse Nightclub to get their friend Tierra Parker.
I really didn't have a second to think about anything. It was just in the moment, like, we have to go get her. And we just went back inside, and we all got stuck.
Carter and Parker survived. Murray did not. That these two survivors did the initial search for victims, it defies the conventional wisdom that police and paramedics do search and rescue. And that's important for those planning for disasters to know. That's the sound of Deputy Mark Rutkowski running toward Pulse Nightclub with a stretcher. It highlights another misconception that paramedics will sort out victims. Instead, police, not paramedics, drag wounded out of the nightclub.
Hey, we're trying to get everybody in a pickup truck.
And victims didn't go by ambulance. Some were loaded into pickup trucks. Orlando Fire Department paramedic Joshua Granada was on scene.
Yeah, I remember distinctly seeing that truck twice when we dropped off patients and telling those guys, you know, great job, let's go back and get some more.
His co-worker Carlos Tavares was in the same ambulance. They transported 13 victims to Orlando Regional Medical Center, sometimes loading four or five people at a time in an ambulance.
A big bus crashes, a plane crashes, a building fire where all these people, here's all the people that are hurt. So we're prepared for that. What you're not prepared for is this machine that was just continuously creating patients. So here's your patients now, well, here's more patients, and here's more patients. So you're always constantly trying to catch up to the person that's injuring people.
It was Orlando Regional Medical Center's job to fix those victims. And that brings up another misconception about mass shootings, the idea that no hospital will get overwhelmed because the ambulances will take those with the less severe injuries to the outlying hospitals. Instead, 44 victims were brought to Orlando Regional Medical Center because it was so close to the shooting. ORMC got 30 patients in the first 20 minutes, and half of those patients went straight to the operating room. And that stretched hospital resources to the max.
There's a little MacGyver going on in all of this.
Dr. Jay Falk is the academic chairman of emergency medicine at Orlando Health. He said they learned the best laid plans don't work the way you expect.
Now lawmakers and state leaders are working to ensure Florida's better prepared. Florida Sheriff's Association President Jerry Demings is calling for legislation that will help officers better track and prevent terrorist activity. And Governor Rick Scott is recommending pay raises for law enforcement officers. Meanwhile, Carlos Guillermo Smith, an openly gay lawmaker, is looking toward legislation aimed at helping Pulse victims. Many were members of the LGBT or lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender community. Guillermo Smith wants to pass legislation barring employers from discriminating against a worker based on their sexual orientation or gender identity. He says he'll also be championing new gun safety measures. Scores of grassroots groups opposed to hydraulic fracturing scored a major victory earlier this year when a highly controversial bill died a slow death in the Senate Appropriations Committee. With a strong backing of the oil and gas industry, the bill would have set up a regulatory framework that opened the door to drilling permits. Miami Senator Anatiri Flores, who was facing re-election in a newly drawn district, spoke for most moderate Republicans when she said it wasn't worth the risk, and Jim Ash was on top of that story.
When Republican Senator Garrett Richter of Naples presented his industry-backed fracking bill to a Senate subcommittee a few weeks ago, he took on a roomful of environmental critics almost single-handedly. That angered Senate Appropriations Chairman Tom Lee.
You know, I'm so disappointed that the proponents of this bill won't stand up here behind Senator Richter and explain to us why this is good public policy.
When he appeared before Lee's committee on Thursday, Richter made sure he brought the cavalry, including Department of Environmental Protection Secretary John Steverson. Richter told the committee his critics were confused by emotion. He was backed by science.
Today, many well-intended, but quite frankly, misinformed people are going to testify against this bill.
But the cavalry may have showed up too late. The bill was voted down after more than 2 hours of debate, but supporters used a procedural maneuver to put it on hold. Backers stressed the bill would ban fracking for a year while a scientific study is conducted. But Democratic leader Arthenia Joyner of Tampa wondered why a study would be necessary when fracking has been linked to everything from flaming tap water to minor earthquakes.
When they dropped the atomic bomb, did we wait till they dropped it on Florida to determine whether it would be harmful?
Richter began working on his bill 3 years ago when a Texas company was caught using a fracking-like technique in Collier County in his district. Fracking generally involves using a high-pressure stream of water and chemicals to blast oil and gas from rocks as deep as 2 miles underground. But that's not the only way to frack, said Jennifer Hecker, a lobbyist with the Nature Conservancy of Southwest Florida. Her group originally supported the bill until she realized it didn't cover another technique called matrix acidation that was used in Collier County.
Things don't have to necessarily fracture the rock to pose the incredible risks.
As we heard in your story that you had earlier this year, Jim Ash, fracking went down to defeat summarily in the Florida legislature. But now, with the Republicans still in control and with more fossil fuel amenable Republicans even in charge on the national level, conventional wisdom might be that fracking might have a bigger chance in the 2017 session. What do you think?
Well, actually, Tom, the environmentalists are more encouraged this year than they ever have been. And that's because there's a couple of Republican legislators now, one in each chamber, who has promised to sponsor a fracking ban. You've got Dana Young in the Senate from Tampa, and you have Mike Miller, a representative from Orlando, both moderate Republicans saying they think fracking is not the way to go in Florida. They've promised to sponsor a ban. However, they haven't filed the legislation yet. And only recently, President Joe Negron, who voted against fracking in the previous session, he's offered a diplomatic response to the fracking bans. He won't say that he opposes a ban, and he won't come out with a full-throated support. Of course, in the end, the big problem for people who want to ban fracking will be the House.
And that was in favor of fracking last year. It could still be in favor this year.
Quite so. However, with the Senate position the way it is, it looks like it's going to end up being a standoff. I don't think a pro-industry bill would pass, and I don't think a complete ban would pass either.
We know you'll be following it every step of the way in the 2017 session, and we'll see what happens. Florida Public Radio's Jim Ash. Thanks, Jim.
Thank you, Tom.
News from Cuba was a big part of 2016's domestic headlines as new ties between the United States and the island were forged in the course of the year. Then came the death of Fidel Castro in November. That news sent Cuban exiles, young and old, into the streets of Miami's Little Havana. Tim Padgett from member station WLRN says both generations recalled Castro with a sense of betrayal and his demise with a sense of hope.
80-year-old Ana Celia watched fellow Cuban exiles dance a conga line in front of the Versailles restaurant in Little Havana. She was 22 when she watched Fidel Castro and his Cuban Revolution march into Havana on New Year's Day, 1959. Ana Celia didn't want to give her last name because she still has family in Cuba, but she says it wasn't long before Castro's communist regime made her feel, as she says, defrauded.
Nos dio mucha alegría porque nos quitaba una dictadura, pero después...
We were so happy because Fidel got rid of a dictatorship for us, she said. Then he brought his own dictatorship with him. Younger Cuban exiles like 35-year-old Lester Perez were at Versailles too. Perez left Cuba 16 years ago because its ragged economy gave him no future as an architect and its regime gave him no future of free expression.
Fidel stole the illusions for so many generations, and maybe things are not going to change tomorrow, but now we feel like change is coming sooner.
Cuba, meanwhile, has announced 9 days of mourning for Castro. I'm Tim Padgett in Miami.
Meanwhile, Governor Rick Scott has sent a letter to Raul Castro, Fidel's brother, urging him to bring absolute freedom and democracy to Cuba. And Scott is offering to help that transition along by providing trade and capital investment assistance. Although he didn't die in Florida and his last job was in California, the Sunshine State system of higher education lost one of its best friends in 2016. That friend was Charlie Reed. Between 1985 and 1998, he headed up the Board of Regents, which was the independent body in charge of the state's university system. In 1998, he left Florida to assume the chancellorship of the much larger California university system. He retired from that job in 2013. That was the year he stopped back in his old Tallahassee stomping grounds and made a speech before the Economic Club of Florida. Most in that audience supposed that Reed would show at least a bit of deference to the Board of Governors that replaced the Regents Board after Reed's departure. More than a few eyebrows were raised when Reed, in his characteristically blunt fashion, fired a shot right across the successor board's bow.
If I have to sum up everything that lies ahead for Florida's system of higher education, I would simply say, you have a lot of work to do.
Much of the work that needs to be done, Reed avowed, is purely financial. Florida, he charged, has been trying to create a world-class system of higher education on the cheap.
We have to improve the funding of higher education and the stability of funding higher education.
Meaning, Reed said, adequate funding by state government is critical. Looking ahead, Florida's new Senate President Joe Negron has been pushing for more state funding for higher education, but it's by no means certain the new House leadership shares that enthusiasm. But former state university system Chancellor Charlie Reed held firm to his belief that almost nothing the state does is more important.
Florida's future, economically and socially, and the prosperity of this state is at stake.
Charlie Reed died on December 6th. He was 75 years old. You're listening to Capitol Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, during the past year, a lot happened in connection with the former Dozier School for Boys near Mariana in the Florida Panhandle. That reform school had a troubled past that included allegations of abuse leading to the deaths of some of the school's young wards. In 2016, state lawmakers and the Florida Cabinet looked for ways to help the families who wanted to rebury the remains of loved ones discovered on the Dozier grounds. Sasha Cordner takes a look back at what happened and what's likely to happen next with this tragic chapter in the state's history.
The organizational meeting of the Dozier Task Force started off very cordial as members introduced themselves, starting with Stephen Britt.
It has been a difficult few months, but I'm sure that we can come together as one cohesive group.
Because of a new state law, Britt, along with the rest of the task force, are charged with two things: create a memorial and determine its location. Some families have claimed the remains of boys who died and were buried on the Dozier grounds in Mariana. The memorial is for the unclaimed ones. It's believed they died due to alleged abuse. An excavation started a few years ago allowed Britt and his family to be DNA matched with the remains of his late uncle Robert Stevens last year.
Imagine a 14-year-old boy walking into a room with his aunts crying because their brother, who they remember was 15 the last time they saw him. I never knew I had an uncle that was murdered up here.
Task Force members can present their own memorial ideas at the next and final meeting, but it's the location that drew the most concern. After speaking to people in his community, Jackson County Commissioner Eric Hill said he believes the memorial should be in a more prominent location.
Maybe the University of South Florida, or someone south of here where the population is greater, then it might serve the recognition of the individuals that were here and went through this would be better served in a larger location.
But that angered Britt.
I am the only one on this task force that have lost a loved one over at that facility. And for Jackson County to even insinuate that they want to move it out of their county when your ancestors performed some of the most diabolical sadomasochistic acts known to man here, what are you afraid of?
But Jerry Cooper, a former ward of the Dozier School, says he, like Hill, wants the memorial at another location. Calling it hell, Cooper says he was sent there as a teenager for running away a third time from an abusive home. Pointing to how long it took for the state to recognize that there were remains buried on the Dozier grounds, he didn't feel a memorial would suffice in that area.
Now, why would we want, as White House boys, to have these kids reinterred on that property when they weren't taken care of in the first place?
The White House Boys, which Cooper leads, is a group of former boys who say they suffered physical or sexual abuse or both in a building on the property labeled the White House, which he and others want destroyed. But like Britt, NAACP Tallahassee branch president Dale Landry wanted the memorial at the Dozier site.
My biggest fear is this, is that once you let it go, then it'll be forgotten. It has to be in that same site.
He suggested the church on the property as a possible memorial site, but Cooper disagreed.
Part of a report that's been done in the last few months that the FDLE opened up another investigation involving sex abuse in the Mariana School for Boys. Some of that sex abuse went on in that church. Can I change your mind?
Well, as we heard, Sasha, a lot of things going on with Dozier during 2016. So what's new now? What might happen during 2017, and what loose ends might there be?
Well, Tom, what you just heard was how passions ran high at that part one of the two meetings for the task force deciding how to create a Dozier memorial and determine its location. In the end, the task force agreed the enclave remains should be buried in Tallahassee, where there will be a memorial. There will also be another in Jackson County, where this happened. And they also agreed on the location of the reinterment of the unenclaimed remains be determined by the Florida legislature. So that means the recommendations are now in the hands of the Department of State, the governor, the cabinet, and state lawmakers. And as for the matter of the White House itself, where the former Dozier boys say a lot of the abuse occurred, as early as late December, they were still saying that they want that building destroyed. But as you heard earlier, some say that could make people forget what happened.
And we'll be following this all the way, as you have, with just great detail and dedication during the past year. Thanks so much, Sasha Fortner.
Thank you.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Jim Ash, Sasha Cordner, Nick Evans, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, and Kate Payne. We also thank our contributing Florida public radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FPR Cap Report, and please join us throughout 2017 for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following: The Able Trust, 25 years of connecting businesses with workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to interview and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. Abletrust.org. WFSU-FM Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.